Healthcare to order. Apologize for being late. We had several bills on here today. We have some folks to talk to us in work sessions. But let me tell you, particularly, I think Senate Bill 34A, Senate Bill 144A, and Senate Bill 656 may not get finished today. We may be carrying those over. Depends on, I think there are some proposed amendments to each of them that I think are not quite ready. So we'll see where they're going. But my guess is we'll end up, I'd like everybody to tell us where they are on each of those bills at the moment. What amendments are here, what amendments are coming. We'll hold them over till, when did we say, Thursday?
Oh, well.
Some tomorrow, some Thursday.
Some Thursday, some next Tuesday.
Some Thursday, some next Tuesday. The boss speaks here, but we'll get on them. But why don't we start with those three, and let's find out where we are in work session. Let me start with, we have Morissette and Cruz hiding back there. There's a Carter over here. Do we have other of our colleagues in the room? Okay. Let's start with 34A. I'll open a work session on 34A. And can somebody tell me where we think we are? We have a bunch of amendments of various kinds. Is that right?
That is right, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, you will recall this is the bill that requires the Board of Pharmacy to establish and maintain a database for electronic reporting of the dispensing of controlled substances. The measure also establishes the Electronic Prescription Drug Database Advisory Commission, and it does other things. You have a fiscal impact from the May 3rd meeting. You also have behind your SMS SB 34-A11 amendments that were just put on the dais a little before 3, but there are also some other amendments pending that council came in and told us will not be ready until tomorrow morning or tomorrow sometime. I don't want to box them in. I believe the requester of those amendments are here to speak to them conceptually because we don't have anything in front of us.
Okay.
And I believe that's where we're at on Senate Bill 34A.
Senator Morissette and Cruz, would you like to start the discussion or be here to react to it? What's your pleasure?
We're hiding. I guess
we know where to find you.
Yes, you do.
Thank you, Senator Bill Morissette, Senate District 6. Something's going on back there.
I don't want to know. Senator Jeff Cruz, Senate District 1, Mr. Chair.
We're prepared to react to the amendment that you have, the dash 11s.
Let's talk about the dash 11s.
Okay. I would like to bring our expert up here on dash 11s. Kathy Hahn, would you introduce yourself, please, and react to the committee to task force idea?
I'm Kathy Hahn, Chair of the Pain Commission. The proposed amendment to create a task force once this session is over is fairly disturbing. We have already had a task force with all members, all interested parties at this task force. I was not able to testify about it because I was not called. We created language in this bill from this task force. One of my concerns is if this task force is created, the money that we have so far is forfeited.
Death by a thousand cuts, Senator Gilmore said. That's a quote from me, I guess. The bottom line is we've had the task force. I killed the bill last time because I didn't think that we were ready for it. We did. I killed it based on the advice of Pain Commission, which I attended several meetings, and they said there's a chilling effect on people who are worried about this, the government coming in and so on and so forth. By the time we got through with our discussion during the interim, the chilling effect had shifted actually to the other side, and the people who were concerned about it were suddenly saying, gee, this is protection for us. Dr. Reinhardt from the Reinhardt Clinic said he's tired of the police coming in and trying to pin something on him for things that, you know, doctor shopping and so on. I think that we've been there, done that. This will kill the bill, and that's fine. We'll face it. We'll regroup, come back next time, but we'll also have an adverse effect on federal grants. I don't know that there should be that connection, but there certainly is. So, like that.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I would agree. One of the ways we can stop progress in the Oregon legislature is to create a task force, and that definitely will stop progress. And we do that on a regular basis, and it's somewhat disturbing. We have studied this not just during this last interim. We have studied this. We have studied the programs in other states. We have studied it for 4 years. I think the time for study is done, and it's time for action. It's time to implement this program. It's good for all pain patients in the state of Oregon. It's good for people in people who have terminal illnesses. It's good for people with chronic pain, and it's good for the providers that are offering them care, so they can have some certainty in what drugs their patients are getting. The protections are in place. It's a good bill. It needs to move forward. It doesn't need to be studied.
Representative Cannon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Senators. I support this program and this idea wholeheartedly. It has been alleged by opponents that to this bill that, you know, not enough planning has been done, that out of the $50,000 in grant money already received, only $10,000 of it has been spent, that we lack sort of detailed information about what this program would look like, what kinds of safeguards would be in place, what kind of technology would be used, and that there are a lot of unanswered questions. So I just want to give you a chance to respond to those allegations, if you will.
Well, number one, very little money has been spent because we don't have a program yet, it wasn't a $50,000 grant, it was a $350,000 grant, and most of it's been sequestered to implement the program. So, there was some front-end expenses, some front-end cost that have been utilized at this point in time, but the bulk of the resources are still in place. As far as the protections in the program, what we have looked at is the experience other states have had in the implementation of the program, and the protections in those programs seem to be adequate. We have not seen abuse, and based on that, we took protections to a slightly higher level than any other state has done. So, you never know for sure what you're going to get till you do it. But my level of confidence in the fact that the information is going to be secure is incredibly high. Now, they will say that people can get access to the information. Quite honestly, they can now. And for example, if you have your prescriptions with Rite Aid, it's in their system, and if somebody wants to break into a pharmacy and steal their records, they can break into the pharmacy and steal their records. You know, there's no way we can protect against all contingencies, but as far as this program is concerned, I think we have adequate safeguards in place.
In the bill, Senator Bill Morissette, there's going to be an advisory commission consisting of 14 members who will be appointed immediately, and I won't read through them because they're in the bill and I'm sure you've seen them. Pain Commission is one of them, the OMA and others. This is going to take a while to implement. And there are safeguards built in as far as the fiscal, which we keep hearing about. Senator Cruz and I spent numerous hours with LFO. LFO was not satisfied with the original plan presented by the Board of Pharmacy because they felt it wasn't detailed enough, and it went over something like $28,000, and so they actually made they made their own work plan, business plan, so to speak, and they said, well, if why doesn't the Board of Pharmacy put in an extra $100,000 as a backup? And so we went to the Board of Pharmacy and suggested that, and they said, fine. And LFO has on their fiscal report the statement that this does not need to come to Ways and Means. Now, that's one part of it. The second part of it is this: the implementation. This is not going to be a secret society made up of whomever that will meet in the dark and create these rules. This is going to be an advisory board that's open to the public, and they will discuss the various aspects of the plan, including sharing information with other states and the standards that will be required to do that. So I just feel that we have answered the objections. We had 9 amendments on the House side, or the Senate side, and we went through them and decided on the... Now, and as far as the OMA, I am extremely disappointed in the OMA as an organization who are taking the position that they don't want to have to pay for something that their physicians may end up... will end up using. The percentage is extremely high who use the program, and I think it's audacity for them to say, under no circumstance do we ever want to pay a fee for a program that is going to save people from doctors, save doctors from this plague of doctor shopping. So,
well, let me say that's not the OMA. It turns out that was the testimony of one of the physicians, but it's not their only objection. The OMA has some pervasive objections to it, as does the as do other groups. I mean, we're in a situation where there is a fair amount of question about what the operations of it's going to be like, and I know Representative Maurer has some real concerns with that. We have some real questions about what the individual safeguards and the extent to which we're talking about this as a criminal justice system versus a prescribing system. And I can tell you, and we'll hear, I hope, yet from the OMA that has much greater concerns about it than the question of who pays for it. I mean, this is, in no sense, we were having some question, a slam dunk on the part of the committee. It currently also has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means, and as of the moment, as of yet this morning, the co-chair of Ways and Means thinks it should go to Ways and Means, and the speaker's in, at the moment in a situation of not quite sure what we do about it, but it's whatever we do about it. So, I mean, this is not in any way a settled issue. And it's certainly not settled in my mind, and it's not settled in other minds. In that.
Okay. Mr. Chair, a couple of the points you made. You know, if the co-chairs have concerns, they ought to talk to their LFO staff, who is perfectly fine with this. I mean, you know, that's what their staff is supposed to do, is advise them, and that is the word we got from the staff who worked this.
They read those words.
Okay. And I'd also point out, Senator Morissette didn't reference everybody that's on that working group, but there is a senator and a representative on that group, so direct oversight of development of the process will be in play. And I guess I always find it interesting when a bill passes one chamber in this building and then suddenly a whole bunch of opposition shows up on the other side of the building, because we fully vetted this, had several hearings on it. At one point in time, the OMA's objection was the funding of the program, and they had an amendment in to exempt physicians from it, and with that amendment they were fine with the bill. So I guess I question why people would be coming forward with other issues at this point in time after we did due diligence on this bill in the Senate. and we spent a great deal of time on it. We spent time on it in the interim as well. And I just find it disingenuous for people to come at the 11th hour and suddenly start objecting to something that has been out there for over a year, and they have had plenty of time to react to.
Well, let me ask you about something specific and the extent to which you heard this in the Senate. We were told this was important because people show up in emergency rooms. They show up at all odd times, and you need to be able to find out what's happening at those times. We now hear the way the program will work is somebody will call in and make a request during the day between 8 and 5, and the answers will be faxed to them the next day. It won't be open at night. It won't be open on the weekends. It won't be open when emergency rooms are open. Was that your sense of how this was supposed to work? Well, you said you vetted it, and I want to know if that's what you
said
you vetted.
There was a gentleman from Eugene who went to the emergency room and said when he got there, he heard someone screaming out of pain, and they refused to diagnose him or give the medicine for him. He was wearing a patch that had run out on a Friday night, and he was in great pain, and he was concerned that no one would believe him if he said he was on a particular medicine. And the response was, well, if this plan were in place, that a call could be made, which it will be at some point. We're trying to make sure that we don't exceed the budget, but the goal is 24/7 coverage by phone is the goal. Online. Okay.
And there's budget to do that?
Yeah, Kathy is the chair of the Pain Commission. She...
addresses, please. Yeah, are you saying there's currently adequate budget to put it up on a real time?
Chair Greenlick, there is enough money between the 340
mm-hmm.
and the 400,000 that we would then be able to apply for online. Now, it might not be, there's a difference between online access and real time. Real time would be every time a prescription is filled, it would be immediately into that that database. Now, that's extremely expensive.
I asked a very specific question. You say you now have in hand, we don't need to go to Ways and Means because you say you have the money in hand. You now have money in hand to put this up and operate it even by phone 24 hours a day, 7 days a week?
Chair Greenlick, it was the determination by Dana Droz, the expert from Ohio that did come to testify, that it would be possible for us to do an online program
for $300,000 and run it for the next 2 years on the same $300,000.
That was her testimony.
Mr. Chair, no.
It really has to go to Ways and Means.
No,
this is the kind of answer we're getting. It really does.
The answer to your question is, could we fully implement today and run it for 2 years on 340,000? No. The plan basically is it's going to take a while to develop it. It's, and we are looking at implementation in line with the budget. Which we do in a lot of things in this building is we delay implementation to fit in the numbers in the budget.
Which means there is not the money to implement it on a operational basis.
Yeah, bring that, yeah.
Mr. Chair, can we have
a protest? Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's my understanding that there is some contingency here upon additional federal funding potentially coming through, and if that's a concern, we could potentially write a caveat in that said, you do this if you get that money. And, I mean, if that would make people feel more secure. I mean, we do this often. We put things out there, and then we say, pending other types of additional resources coming in, it's not that unusual. But if it would make sense to maybe clarify that we need that additional federal grant to get this to the finish line, then maybe we should put that in the bill. Okay. But I don't know if that should keep us from having the discussion.
We have an expert here.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, my name is Karen McLean from the Oregon Board of Pharmacy. I'm the administrative director, and I've been working very closely with this bill and the budget associated with it. And as you can appreciate through the legislative process, there have been a lot of changes to the bill and a lot of changes since our original plan. Even in the last week, there has been a lot of discussions about being able to go and augment this program to be a 24/7 live program that would be live data within a week of it being filled within the pharmacy. Our IT expert, who is in the room, has put together a budget that we believe we would be able to work within the $340,000 that we have in our budget, not even using that $100,000, and create a secure environment and be able to gather the information and run this program from an implementation date of the middle of next year, because obviously there will take some planning time to get this in place once the legislation is passed and the task force is convened in order to set all of the rules for this database. We believe that we will be able to run this thing for 2 years with the money that we have and be able to hire the staff that we need. It may mean that we don't hire two staff. It may mean that we only hire one, and that would be adequate within this program. And Dana Droz from Ohio indicated that we could do that, and so she got me in touch with some experts that gave me information about what they would be able to provide to us, and I was able to provide it to our IT professional, and he was able to look at it, evaluate it, and develop a program for me that would identify that we could be able to live within that budget of $340,000.
And you would have one staff person, and they'd be available 24 hours a day,
no,
7 days a week?
It wouldn't need to be a 24/7 person, because the database would be a 24/7 database once the system is up, which is targeted at this time to be next July 1st, once the final implementation takes place from the task force.
So you wouldn't mind an amendment that said it could not go up before it was available 24/7, since that's in your plan and you have no problem with that?
I don't think I would mind that at all. That would be fine.
You all have no problems with that? Is that?
Mr. Chair, I, from the very beginning, I've always thought that we have to make something that works. And I, as I mentioned, was opposed to this in 2005 because I didn't see, there were several extenuating circumstances, and since then we have been looking at a program on how to put something together that actually works. Now, the expertise of the people who are going to run the program is extremely important. I heard about the person from the IT that you were referring to just today, and he does have expertise and credibility, and I think that that's important, that we don't try to start something that we're not ready for. So I think that the purpose of the task force, the advisory committee, is to make sure that everything is ready to go as it's ready, as it develops.
Mr. Chair, if your comfort level is increased by not going online till we're fully online, I have no problem with that.
Senator Mauer?
Mr. Chair, you mentioned my name, and I just want to clarify where I stand on this. I mean, we need this. This is absolutely vital to the state of Oregon, given the way we prescribe opioids in the state. But I will have to say that that the lobbyist for the ACLU brought up some very valid points after her testimony. We've had some conversations, and some of the points are very valid, and I think that in the rule process that many of those can be addressed, but I also think it is imperative that we have a system that works from essentially day one, and that a fax-back system is completely unacceptable, and that it has to be accessible 24/7 or the system is just not going to work. And you can beta the system and test it out, but when you go live, you need to make sure your ducks in a row, that the server is secure, that the information is secure, that the rules are in place for how we're going to work with disclosure, you know, inappropriate disclosure of data, which is absolutely vital. And I'm the comment about making sure that we don't send this out into the public, so to speak, until it's 24/7 available, I think really pushes the hurdle up pretty high that we're going to have answered a lot of the questions. I just want to be sure that we don't have a system that has a bunch of holes in it, and that's not going to be used by the providers, particularly in the emergency room, and that the system is good for everybody involved. And at the end of the day, next biennium, who's going to pay for it? And where do we go from there?
Mr. Chair, Representative Maurer, we left that question. And we left that question quite simply because there are a couple ways we could pay for it. One is we could allocate general funds to do it, or we could institute a fee to do it. I guess we're leaning a little bit towards fee. But what we wanted to do is have this thing on the ground and running so we get enough experience data to fully understand who the main utilizers of the program were and set a fee structure that would be accordingly if we choose to go that way. You know, for example, if pharmacists were using it 70% of the time and physicians 30%, we would set a fee structure that would match that or any other percentage you'd want to do. So we purposely left that question in abeyance with full intention of addressing that in 2009 when we come back here again, because then we'll have some experience in operation to be able to inform our decision as to what it's going to cost long term and what the most appropriate way to pay for it would be. So we purposely left that for the future, just because we thought that was the most appropriate thing to do. You know, Mr. Chair, I have, you know, if it is a comfort to this committee that this not go online till it's fully operational, which I think would also give us the opportunity to make sure that the concerns Representative Maurer has will be addressed, because this task force will address all those concerns. The advisory committee. So if that increases your comfort level to add that language, I'm perfectly fine with it.
Mr. Chair, actually, in some ways, the future is now, because there is an enhancement grant that is available currently of $400,000 to enhance the program once it starts. 24/7 is an enhancement. And that should get us through that initial phase. Would you like to speak?
Members of the committee, our understanding is that once implementation takes place, we would be eligible for an enhancement grant. The enhancement grant is in the amount of $400,000, any enhancements that we would want to make to this program. And the 24/7 Live would certainly fit within that. Funds are able to be carried forward with federal grants, and we would intend to carry those funds forward into the new biennium to help fund ongoing enhancements and ongoing work with this program into 2007-9/11. So that would be the intention, would be able to do that. In addition to that, it is our understanding that there are some other federal grants that once we have an implemented program, we would be eligible to apply for, and that would be a fully expected route that we would go, perhaps even before looking at additional fees from any licensees of any kind.
Let me clarify what you're saying, though. Are you saying that once implemented, you mean operational 24/7? Is that what you mean by implemented?
If that is the decision of this committee, that implementation requires 24/7 live, then that once that is implemented, we would be eligible to apply for an enhancement grant, yes. And there are other things that other programs add as they go along, reporting features, ways to analyze the data in different ways, and that is a natural evolution of these programs.
Well, I think we're interested in making sure we can work this out as best we can. We've got some amendments coming. I'll hold it over till Thursday, and we'll schedule it for next Tuesday as well if we need to make sure we have enough time. I want to work it out here the extent to which we can, and that's what we'll try and do. So stay calm.
We're always calm.
No. Thank you very much. I want to stop the bleeding, so I will stay calm.
We'll have to close the work session. House Bill 34. I'm sorry, Senate Bill 34. House bills don't come that small, right?
That's right.
And open a work session on Senate Bill 656. Another bill in which we have a set of amendments.
We have several amendments.
Of various kinds. Let's see if we can get some folks. Senator Carter, do you want to have some opening remarks, or do you just want to sit and enjoy the play?
Mr. Chairman, I'd love to say
We were hoping Nan would join us, and Bill Cross wants to join us as well. Is that right? And where's my bill file? Join the party. Pretty handle it today for us.
I get to carry the wet water on it.
Okay. Nan, you want to start?
1656.
You have a few amendments here?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Nan Heim, representing the Oregon Academy of Ophthalmology. Would you like for me just to go through the amendments, Mr. Chair?
Please.
The Dash 4 amendments, which define a combination medication, we are fine with that amendment.
That makes a combination a single medication.
And it makes it a single medication. We're fine with that. The Dash 6s that provide a general definition of the time for consultation, we're fine with that, except we would prefer that on line 7, the consultation be with an ophthalmologist, not with another medical or osteopathic physician. And the reason
reinstates.
And it also reinstates.
Reinstates the part that's deleted on the first.
Right.
So it
that's
does
correct.
Two things.
It does okay. Two things, correct.
And there was some language you had on what worsening means. Do you have an amendment on that?
Do I?
Or call it worsening. Yeah, I saw some language.
It's in the dash 6.
No, it's not the dash 6. See if I can find what you're talking about.
Line 9 is the dash 6.
Okay, that's all we have right now.
From Nan.
From you. Is that right?
Yes, Mr. Chair. You and I talked about specifying a number of points that eye pressure might rise, because according to the ophthalmologist whom I asked about that, it's because there's so many different types and it's complicated. It's not so much the initial starting point of the pressure, but how much it rises. And so we talked about that, but I did not. I don't think there's an. I haven't seen an amendment to that effect.
I didn't see an amendment. I saw some language as well. Okay.
Mr. Chair?
Yep.
Line 9 in the dash 6 talks about worsening in the eye pressure.
And in the original bill, Mr. Chair, the worsening is lines 18 and 19.
Okay.
But you were looking for something more specific, and we... and you and I had the conversation about 5 points.
All right. We don't have it yet. Wayne, you want to...
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Wayne Schumacher. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Optometric Physicians Association. Our two amendments actually are pretty similar in language. There's just some minor language changes, and that's the dash 5s and the dash 7s. After the testimony at the last hearing, we essentially came up with two determinations. Again, Senator Carter was extremely emphatic about an issue that she felt was within her constituency and her district, which was, as near as I can tell, without putting words in her mouth, I think was more of an access issue and a population that's being underserved. I think based on the testimony and the questions from the committee, we determined that there was a question whether or not 656 was addressing that issue. And our amendments 5 and 7 were to address Senator Carter's issue, because we were very sensitive to that and frankly feel that that needs to be addressed. Overall, we still are questioning, and I think we heard testimony that, first of all, the initial consult, the testimony in the Senate as well as here in the last hearing, was that there really wasn't a lot of value in that. The number two would be is, what problem are we trying to solve by creating another consult, which typically when a individual has a medication change, nowadays it's standard of practice to notify the primary care physician. So if we were to look at 4 and 6, the question is are we addressing the problem, which questionably is, what is the problem? We think that 5 and 7 sets up a mechanism that already exists to try and determine what's the problem. I don't think we've determined that yet. And so those are our concerns and the reason for 5 and 7. I'm glad to answer any questions.
Are there questions of any of the witnesses? Yes, sir. Come and join us.
I think I'm going to speak for myself.
Please. I think that's probably better.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Margaret Carter, Senate District 22, North Northeast, Portland. If you will recall in my first original testimony to you, the situation was that I felt that there was a lack of communication between some of the constituency of mine that came to the screening, between the conditions of the eyes when they first started going to an optometrist, between that time and the time when they went to see an ophthalmologist, when hospitals finally say you can go to an ophthalmologist. Most of the time, the eye condition was so bad that there was no returning from almost being at the point of blindness in terms of what they had reported to us that day. My original language was refer. I only changed to consult because that was the optometrist language. And in a position of trying to compromise, that's why we came to the word consult. So I want to make that clear and for the record.
Great.
Thank you.
And
Mr. Chair, actually, Senator, this is a question for you, if I may.
Thank you.
So, is the question, it's not about access?
No.
Okay.
About quality.
Say it again.
It's about quality.
Yes.
Okay.
Is that a project?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It might be helpful to talk about what we do agree on. I think you do agree on the fact that glaucoma is progressive, that if you miss it and don't have the proper treatment and there's not the proper timely consult, there could be a more likelihood that that person will go blind by the time they get the proper consultation. I think optometric physicians have done a good job. I don't think there's a rampant problem out there. However, I think any person who goes blind because they haven't had the consult is a problem. And while we wait to figure out what the problem is, I think the language in, A6 is very reasonable because it's basically trying to put into statute what should already be the best practice. And so I guess my question is, does the dash A6 not reflect what should be best practice and is happening now?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kotek, I would disagree that it needs to be in statute. What essentially you're taking is professional determination and requiring one class of provider to adhere to something that's in statute. And I know Dr. Story got a little out of line in his comment last hearing, but I think his point was well taken. Why not make this the standard for all physicians? not just optometric physicians, if you feel that strongly about it. What it would say, if we're putting this in statute, is that only optometry needs to be under that microscope.
Yes.
Mr. Chair. I guess my follow-up comment would be, with, we have looked at other bills this session where we have put some protocols in statute about, for example, prescribing psychologists, not very far off from what has been dealt with the prescribing authority for optometrists in terms of making them consult with a child psychologist or psychiatrist, excuse me, if they're working on a particular situation. I don't think it is outside the scope of what we've done for other professions. Now, in terms of who else you would add to this list, I'm not sure who that would be. If the person's seeing an ophthalmologist, they don't need to be on this list. The optometric physicians are the issue here, and I don't think this is unnecessarily restrictive. So maybe you can convince me otherwise.
Senator Bonamici and then Representative Cannon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Might there be a situation where a family practice doctor or nurse practitioner prescribes anti-glaucoma medication or eye drops? Or is it only optometrists and ophthalmologists who treat glaucoma?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bonamici, my name is Bob Tybalt. I'm an ophthalmologist in Salem and legislative chair for the Oregon Academy of Ophthalmology. Only optometrists and ophthalmologists treat glaucoma because only they have the expertise and the instrumentation to monitor, first to diagnose it and then to monitor it. A family practice physician might do a fundus exam, even dilate the pupil and look in the back of the eye, look for glaucoma, but that individual doesn't have the expertise to diagnose glaucoma and certainly doesn't have the experience, expertise, or instrumentation to monitor glaucoma. So the answer is optometrists and ophthalmologists are the only practitioners who treat glaucoma.
Just follow up for clarification. And then there is a suggestion that anybody should be referred, not just or anybody should refer to an ophthalmologist, not just optometrist. So who are we talking about then? There was a suggestion made that why does this just apply to optometrists who are treating and referring to ophthalmologists? Why shouldn't anybody have to refer to ophthalmologists? Who are we talking about if it's only optometrists and ophthalmologists who treat glaucoma?
That's for you, I think. Right? Mr. Chair, Representative Bonamici, the issue was it singling out for a particular protocol only optometry. The point is well made, and I think that usually almost 99.9 cents, I would say, obviously, that glaucoma medication is going to be prescribed by an optometrist or an ophthalmologist. I mean, in all reality, potentially, however, because an MD or DO can probably do just about anything, they could technically prescribe that medication. As Dr. Tubel has pointed out, it's highly unlikely that they would. One other point to address the dialogue that was going back and forth on tonight, Mr. Chair. We've gone from an initial consult to now two consults, so we've actually doubled our money here, so to speak, and that's another concern we have with six. I mean, we heard testimony in the Senate. We heard testimony here by ophthalmology that consult, the initial consult, really did not have any value. So, again, that we'd have some concern about that language in six.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And sort of the point I wanted to make was just that we've heard from the optometrists repeatedly that they don't want this kind of protocol in the statute. And I think it's important to understand that it's already in there. We have crossed that bridge. I sort of wish we didn't do that because I hate these kinds of bills and I don't want to have more of them. So, I don't like going there, but the fact is we're there already, and I think our obligation as a committee is to do the best we can to figure out when that consult ought to be, how often that consult ought to be, what kinds of triggers we ought to have. But I'm not at all convinced by the argument that we shouldn't put protocol into statute since it's already there in the case of glaucoma and optometry. So that's just my take on this.
Sure.
Yes.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a question about glaucoma more than the procedure here, and I would address it to you, Dr. Kimball. part of the language of the dash six is reinstating if the patient's glaucoma is worsening in terms of eye pressure control, visual function, or structural abnormality. And my question is, for people, this is a, as you and I discussed, this is a chronic condition. For the most part, people don't acquire and don't get to glaucoma and cure it somehow, or it goes away. Once they have it, you have it. How often, I'm thinking in terms of other diseases, I can't think of a chronic disease that doesn't get worse over time. I mean, how often a glaucoma does the condition stay the same? Even if it's well treated, I mean, 10, 20 years down the road, somebody has glaucoma, I assume that the glaucoma is going to be worse in most situations than it was the day that treatment began.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bruin, glaucoma is a progressive disease, and even in the under the situation of the best of management, there is loss of optic nerve structure and function with aging. In fact, even in non-glaucomatous individuals, there is an age-related decline in the number of optic nerve fibers and the visual function. But that is a physiologic change. The physiology of aging leaves people with vision before they, when they die. The goal of glaucoma management is to, it's a strange way to think of it, but the goal is to make sure that they die before they go blind. There is progressive loss under any circumstances, whether one has glaucoma or not, but it's a race between the longevity of the individual's life and how long that glaucomatous optic nerve is going to hang around and allow them to function and see. So that's the challenge in managing glaucoma.
Can I follow up on your
Can
question?
I do a quick follow-up? Well, you're the chair. I mean,
No, go ahead. No, please go ahead.
I guess my question, let me a little more narrow. Somebody that's had glaucoma for 20 years, 9 times out of 10, they're going to have a worsening condition? 8 times out of 10, I mean...
It's been in 20 years anyway, is what you're saying.
Right, and so I guess, and that would lead to my follow-up, and there's, by looking at the dash sixes, is there ever going to be a case, I mean, I realize the 1 out of 100 or the 1 out of 1,000, but for the most part, is there ever going to be a case where a glaucoma patient didn't qualify in a worsening condition to be referred back to?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bruin, the sensitivity of our tests to monitor glaucoma is limited. Even the best technology that we have right now is still crude compared to identifying the actual loss of function and loss of vision. That is to say, when a visual field defect worsens in our visual field test, that means there has been a gross loss of vision. And so what you say is true. There will always be worsening, but the goal is to minimize that worsening so that it is not detectable. That is to say, so that you preserve whatever vision they have. There will be a very small incremental loss of vision in glaucoma that is properly managed.
And so that would not be detectable, and that would not qualify as worsening.
I think the issue really has to do with there's the sort of carefully diagnosed glaucoma, which has to do with a whole set of characteristics, but there's also the fact that interocular pressure can change over time for a variety of reasons. I mean, I had, for example, a relatively high interocular pressure post-surgical that sort of popped up, and then I think at that moment I would have been characterized as having glaucoma without the full other diagnosis, and then it did go away. I mean, and it did become normal because it was post-surgical, not something inherent. And what worries me, I mean, I like the bill in its current form, I like the dash four amendments, but I still want some understanding of what some clearer definition of what worsening means. And I'm sure even the average glaucoma patient, he'll take interocular pressures over time, and they'll be a little up, and they'll be a little down, and they'll be a little up, and they'll be a little down. And the question is, when are they worsening? And it is clear with field defects and some other issues, optic nerve defects, but it seems to me we need, if we're going to go with something like 656, which I definitely favor, we ought to have some way that clarifies some language about worsening rather than the general language here, because I think it's going to be very hard to specify what this means.
Mr. Chair, that was frankly the other reason for our two amendments, 5 and 7, was to create, well, actually not create because it already exists, and that was to charge the non-topical formulary committee, which consists of three optometrists, three MDs, ophthalmologists, and a pharmacist, and to determine maybe what those protocols should be, as opposed to trying to force y'all to try to do that. And so that was the reason for our amendment, was to try and if it wasn't effectively to address Senator Carter's issue, which now I guess it would, is to determine what is that, what are those thresholds. We're arguing some pretty hefty technicalities here that I think are even less definable as you start to look at them. So,
Mr. Chair, we would be happy to work on a definition, and we would be happy to work with Wayne on a definition. And if I may, I think our reasons for introducing this bill have really never been clarified, and that is, after speaking with Senator Carter, we surveyed our members to see, in fact, if they felt there was a problem, if they were getting patients beyond the point at which, I mean, not beyond the point that could do any good, but could they have saved vision if they had gotten patients earlier? And we actually were surprised by the number of examples that people reported back to us, and that is why we sought the bill. And we would be happy to work on a definition of worsening.
If it's all right with the committee, I'll be happy to work with them and see if we can work something out. Yes,
thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate your comments, ma'am, and here's what I'm seeing in my bill file, and I recall the testimony that we had when this first came forward, or I'm looking at my notes saying that that the evidence of complaints was anecdotal and there was no database. And so, but what I'm hearing from ophthalmologists is good bill should pass. What I'm hearing from optometrists is no way, no
bad
how.
Bill should fail.
What I'm hearing from ophthalmologists who have optometrists within the scope of their building and their practice and service to clients is, we don't need this because we're doing it anyway. Hmm. Because they're in a working partnership. Hmm. The optometrist is in the building. As a matter of fact, I just had an eye doctor appointment last week here in Salem with an ophthalmologist who had an optometrist is part of the practice and service to clients. So I'm interested to see what can be brought forward to help resolve the issues between you.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Flores, the nature of glaucoma is such that if there is a good working relationship between an optometrist and an ophthalmologist, this may already be happening. I have an optometrist in my office. I work with two community optometrists who refer patients to me, and we have a relationship, and basically it's a good relationship, and these things are satisfied. But there are many cases in which those environments are just don't exist. There are optometrists who are not in a relationship with an ophthalmologist and manage the patient's glaucoma, and there is loss of vision. And we see it over and over again. It happens. And we have tried to inform you about that it's not a trivial number of times that this happens. And that's a fact. And that, from our perspective, because those patients end up with us, we see it. And so what we would like to do is to raise the standard of care so that every patient who's at risk for losing vision from glaucoma has the opportunity to have his or her case reviewed by an ophthalmologist and maximize the chance of preservation of vision. That's all we're asking.
Senator Carter, do you have a position on the A2 amendments, or a request to exclude optometrists practicing in a county with a population of less than 50,000?
Representative Butler presented them at the May 3rd meeting.
The opening meeting.
At the first meeting.
It would exclude counties of less than 50,000 population. Perhaps you can consult on that. We can talk about that after.
Well, the only thing I see, that there's A consultation could include a phone call, so I don't see why we should exclude anyone. And in today's society, we have, you know, telephones, internet, and faxes, and cell phones in addition to land phones. I just think there is no reason to not have consultation, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, Senator, what I recall hearing is that consultation, an optometrist picks up the phone, calls an ophthalmologist regarding a prognosis or what have you, and oftentimes results in, well, you better send the patient over. So it is more than a consult. It is now a doctor visit, which for the patient, presumably, or oftentimes would. So, as I recall, Rhett Butler saying is that there are far fewer ophthalmologists in what we consider rural and remote counties.
Right. I think all of you who know me know that over the years, I am a person who tried very hard to make sure that we have as much service in rural Oregon as possible. That's just been who I have been for the last 22 years. But I think that in talking with Dr. Tibble and some of the other people, they have ophthalmologists just about all over the state. And I still say, even if there's not an ophthalmologist there certainly could be a phone call where there's consultation.
Thank you.
I just want to add one point, Mr. Chair, Representative Flores. It is true, if in the consultation the ophthalmologist feels that a personal visit is necessary, then there might be some travel involved. The point of the bill is that may happen sooner or later anyway. The point of the bill is to try to have that happen soon enough to save vision.
All right. I don't think there's any dispute on the A4s. Can we have a motion to adopt the A4s, which defines that a combination of two agents is considered one medication?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I'd move the -4 amendments to Senate Bill 656.
Any discussion? Any objection? The A4s are now a product. I can just remember that when we come back on Thursday. My intention would be to try and get pretty close to the A and Gross version of 656 and to try and work with folks, with Nan and Wayne, and see if we can get a clearer definition of what progressing is. It's going to be progressing if there's a worsening. So it's that phrase. See if we can do something about that.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
And before Senator Carter leaves,
almost got away.
Not a question, but I just would like to read my notes from Representative Butler, because I know he is out of the building as well. But he testified that optometrists in his rural county, they have no ophthalmologists in his rural county. Nothing near for the consult if the patient does need to be sent over, and that his concern was that many Idaho docs do not accept Oregon Health Plan. That would be the next closest locality where people could possibly go, but they do not accept OHP. So just to inform your thinking there.
Thank you very much. There was a work session on Senate Bill 656. Let's see if we can get something easy, huh? Can we open a public hearing on Senate Bill 188? See if we can find out what this is about. Is this the first public hearing?
It is, Mr. Chair.
You want to tell us about 188?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 188 requires that health professionals complete a minimum practice requirement in time period immediately following their completion of training requirements or the execution of the Rural Health Services Agreement. It adds dentists to the list of health professionals who may qualify for the Rural Health Services Program. It also directs the Office of Rural Health to select qualifying practice sites for the program and allows the Oregon Student Assistance Commission to give preference to participants who agree to practice in certain communities. This left the Senate floor with 27 ayes and 3 excused. Has no revenue impact, and you do have, and you should have, a fiscal statement. And it is just a fiscal statement attached to your SMS.
It's anticipated.
It is anticipated in the governor's recommended budget, but it provides you with some additional information, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Thank you. Can we start with Scott Egbert and Rachel Cummings? And then we'll talk to our friends from Willamette Dental. Is this going to be an easy one, everybody?
Certainly not a spicy one.
Maybe not. All right. Who's going to kick us off here?
All right, you have to Chair Greenlick, Vice Chair Kotek, members of the committee. My name is Scott Ekblad. I'm the Director of the Oregon Office of Rural Health. And I can promise you that this one will be far easier than the conversations you've been having earlier. You should be receiving my written testimony at the moment. And I'm going to give you a much briefer version verbally here. But I want to tell you a little bit about how important the Rural Health Services Program, loan repayment program, is to rural communities and some of the fine-tuning that it really requires, and that's what we're after here in Senate Bill 188. The program was created in 1989 and funded at a level of $400,000 per biennium, and so not that you can't do your own math, but I want to point out that that's a grand total of $200,000 per year to use in awarding for loan repayment for rural physicians, nurse practitioners, physician assistants. Last session, pharmacists were added to the program. So it's not a whole lot of money, but we've done some very good things with the amount of money that we've had to date. Since 1994, which is the first year that awards were actually made, 122 healthcare professionals have been awarded loan repayment through this program. Of 122 awardees, 20% are currently receiving payment. In other words, they're currently working in a qualifying area and receiving loan repayment. 38% have already completed the obligations of the program. And 42% of the people who were awarded loan repayment either declined or forfeited their award. We believe that the 71 practitioners who have or are currently completing the program are excellent examples of this program's success. However, we would very much like to change the percentage of loan repayment awardees that end up declining their award when push comes to shove. We would like to see that number decrease. There have been a lot of bills that have come before you this session already that tell you about the impending shortage of healthcare professionals and their maldistribution from rural to urban and how it's so very difficult to recruit physicians and other healthcare practitioners to rural communities. So I won't dwell on that a whole lot, but I do want to tell you that during our town hall meetings, which we conducted during the last part of 2005, it was a reoccurring theme. The difficulty in recruiting healthcare professionals to rural communities is once again truly reaching near crisis levels. I also want to mention, before I move on, that the Office of Rural Health does have a governor-appointed advisory body called the Rural Health Coordinating Council, and the Rural Health Coordinating Council is very much behind Senate Bill 188 as well. You'll notice that on pages 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, and 8 are various graphs that begin to tell you a little bit about why we're facing such a shortage of physicians, particularly in rural communities. The graph on page 3 just...
Tom, why don't we stipulate that? I don't think you have
okay.
to convince us.
Thank you very much. All right. I want to give you a little bit of experience of the recruitment program in our office, in the Office of Rural Health. I actually began in the Office of Rural Health as the recruiter 15, 16 years ago, and at that time it was not at all uncommon to have a success rate of maybe 30 placements in rural communities per year. And what I've seen, both in my time in that position and now that I'm actually supervising that position, that our success rate in actually successfully being successful in finding something to go to a rural community is starting to decline. And what I hear almost entirely is that the reasons are financial. There are other reasons as well, but the economic reasons are really primary for these folks when it comes time to decide whether or not to settle down in a rural community. I'm going to wrap up, and I want to also let you know that Rachel Cummings from the Oregon Student Assistance Commission is here. Should you have any questions about the actual administration of the program?
Scott, can you tell us about the bill?
Yep. I'm going to wrap up by telling you what this bill will actually do. One of the problems with the way the program is as it currently exists, and I'm beginning on page 9 of my testimony, the loan repayment awards are currently given directly to candidates and not tied to a specific practice site. So in other words, it's possible for a candidate, an applicant, to get a loan repayment award without having a commitment to a qualifying practice site already. And that's probably the largest reason that there are so many people who end up declining their award before they actually start beginning their practice obligation. What this bill would do is to direct the Office of Rural Health to begin a qualifying process for practice sites as well, so that we could give a list of practice sites to the candidates who want to apply for the award, and there could be preference given to an actual contract or a match between an eligible site and an eligible candidate. The second thing that this bill would do is switch the period of obligation. And let's take physicians, for example. For physicians who get loan repayment, they must work in a qualifying site for 3 of 5 years. However, they can do their 3 of 5 years in years 3, 4, and 5. And so that essentially what happens is that the funds that are set aside for a loan repayment award are encumbered for 1, 2, sometimes even 3 years before the awardee is able to actually decline the award. Until they cash that check, they're not obligated to do anything. And so funds are encumbered, and we want to get away from that scenario by saying, no, you have to do your obligated service at the beginning of that period of time. The third thing this bill would do is allow us to raise matching funds for this program in amounts that rural communities can afford to give. The way that program's currently implemented, you either give a percentage of the indebtedness of the awardee or a maximum of $20,000 to $25,000, depending on your profession. We would like to be able to go out and raise matching funds for this program, and if a community can only raise $5,000, that's great, and we don't want that to really serve to penalize them compared to communities that can raise $10,000, $15,000, or $20,000. And finally, problem number 4, the program currently does not include dentists as an eligible profession, and we feel that the shortage of dentists is just as dire as that of medical professionals, so we'd like to add dentists to the program.
Are there any questions?
Sure.
Yep.
Thanks, Scott. These are student loans only. These aren't new practice loans. This isn't somebody going to get a small business startup loan to go open a new dentist office in Rome.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bruin, that's correct. They are student loans only, and in fact, the list of those that qualify, I believe, are in statute.
And if somebody, Mr. Chair, if somebody doesn't have an existing loan, i.e. they paid off their loan or never had loans to start with, they couldn't qualify under some sort of, hey, I had a loan. I mean, you're really only attracting people here that do have outstanding debt. Anybody that isn't in that situation, we can't attract them as well.
Sure, hard to find somebody that's graduated from medical school.
I'm sure that's true.
Without $20,000 in debt.
Yeah, that's true.
Yes, but the Student Assistance Commission actually does not subtract the amount of loans that have already been paid, let's say. So let's say if they borrowed $100,000 to get through medical school and they've already paid off $20,000, it's quite possible that actually I think the statute ties our hands and we would give $100,000 of loan repayment.
Mm-hmm.
Maximum,
yeah.
Could you please introduce yourself?
Oh, hello, Chair Greenlick. I'm Rachel Cummings. I'm with the Oregon Student Assistance Commission.
have a question.
Yes, please.
Question on how this actually works. A young medical student graduates. They've got their residency set ahead of them. They're going to decide their residency while they're in their final year of medical school. The residency is going to last, what, 2 to 4 years?
4 years.
Okay, 4 years. And they're not going to be able to work their residency in any area that will qualify. So they're going to be someplace else doing the residency. And at some time in this process, they're going to say, even though I don't even know what a residency really is, other than what I kind of think I do because I'm in medical school and I've done some rotations, and I'm going to be in this area, I'm going to commit to going to a rural area 4 years from now? Or is it sometimes when they're working on a rotation doing surgery in downtown LA or something, that, or in Portland, that they're going to make this decision that they're going to go to a rural area? I mean, realistically, how does that work for a medical student who's in this process of becoming a fully qualified physician to make that kind of decision? And what's the likelihood that they're actually going to do that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Richardson, actually, the ideal candidate for this program would be someone who is already in their residency program, residency training program. So a second or third year resident would probably rate better in the evaluation process as a likely candidate for the program, specifically for because of the reasons that you alluded to, and that is that it's very hard for anyone to make a decision that they can stick with after 3 years of residency training and the life-changing experience that could be.
Okay, so we're going to do this even though...
Well, how does it work? I mean, essentially you get second or third year family physicians, mostly.
Correct, second or third year residents, or people who are already out in practice. They've finished medical school, they've finished their residency training, they've begun practicing in Salt Lake City, but they decide that, you know, they just really need help in getting their loans paid off. They always wanted to practice in a rural community anyway. They hear about this loan repayment program. That would really be an ideal candidate, frankly.
Just a quick comment is, it seems to me for this to really work, we need to have a piece of it where you're recruiting students that grew up in Rome or in John Day, who have family, who have, you know, they marry out there, right? And all these other things, so that they could then get help going to medical school and they get their bills paid if they come back home, because they're more likely to have a spouse that'll be happy there because of the social life, for lack of it, and all those other factors.
I think Representative Richards is trying to figure out how to get his son-in-law back.
I'm afraid it's a lost cause.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, please.
If I may, Scott, your last scenario is actually now taken out of possibilities because it has to be immediately following the completion of your residency.
Mr. Chair, Representative Maurer, it also says or upon completion of the agreement with the Student Assistance Commission.
Okay. Yes.
Okay.
I have a conflict with this bill because we've had two nurse practitioners who have participated in it, and one of the problems that we have experienced is getting a provider that was on the program and then moved to an area that was in an urban area, Medford, and now they want to come back in. They realize, uh-oh, I made a big mistake. I want to get back in. And once they're out, they're out. There's no back in. And so that's been an issue a couple times. It's certainly not the end of the world, but we have taken advantage of it. Not our clinic, but employees of.
Would your clinic be a pre-designed site? Is that the notion?
We are a rural health clinic, yes.
Oh, right.
So that would qualify.
So you would name them in advance as a designated site? Or do you not need to?
Mr. Chair, we could, and I would like to implement that part of the procedure where for example, they would simply fill out an application letting us know that they are recruiting, that they do need a full-time person, that they do have the resources to make sure that person's salary is paid for the next 3 years or whatever the minimum commitment is, et cetera, then be able to get it to the list of interested candidates so that Representative Maurer could talk to and enter some sort of memorandum of agreement with a potential loan repayment awardee before this money is invested and the Student Assistance Commission actually makes a loan repayment award.
Mr. Chair, I think that is critical in the recruitment process because these small clinics, frankly, don't have the ability to go out, the ability or the time to go out and search, and his office does a good job of doing that kind of thing, and that's what they're there for. So.
All right. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And we have the Willamette Dental Gang. Craig Allen and Doug Barber. Dr. Allen, welcome back. We haven't been here for a couple of weeks. We've been missing you. I think we passed that dental hygiene bill out of the Senate this week. Is that right?
I believe so. Thank you.
Including Representative Kotek's amendment.
Gave a lot of honor.
Right. Yes, sir. And we've already accepted the amendments. It's on its way to the governor.
Great. Chair Greenlee, members of the committee, I'm Doug Barber here today on behalf of Willamette Dental Group. Willamette Dental is one of the largest staff model dental practices in the country. We currently have 27 offices in Oregon, also have offices in Washington, Idaho, and Nevada. And Willamette Dental has been an active participant in the Oregon Health Plan since its inception. In our efforts to expand access to dental services throughout Oregon, we've continued to add offices in underserved areas of the state. On the map that is being handed out to you right now, you'll see some of our newest offices that are in Tillamook, Lincoln City, and North Bend. Currently, we are also working with a health clinic in Warrenton to see if we can co-locate a dentist there. And with me today is Dr. Gary Allen, the dental director at Willamette Dental, to talk about the challenges that we face in recruiting dentists to our more rural locations.
Chair Greenlee, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak in support of this bill, Senate Bill 188, and particularly with the inclusion of dentists to this legislation. And speaking from practical experience, due to the growth of our company and opening up new offices, the shortage of dentists nationwide, and turnover, we have considerable challenges to recruit dentists to come to work into the rural communities. For a number of years, some of those challenges were just the somewhat onerous licensing requirements, but thanks to your support over the last couple of sessions and working with the Board of Dentistry, those have been relaxed to be reasonable, so we have good success recruiting dentists nationwide to this area, but we still have considerable challenges getting them to the rural communities. Checking with our provider relations department, we have almost continuous openings in our rural offices, and we advertise those nationwide. In the last 18 months, we've had only 3 inquiries from general dentists for openings in our rural offices, and that's not been a problem in our more urban offices. The problem is even more acute for our for specialists attracting them to those communities. We found it necessary to provide or to offer a bonus incentive of $30,000 to $60,000 per year for dentists to take positions in our rural offices. And a lot of this obviously is for the new graduates. It's related to their concerns about being able to pay off their graduating dental school debt. According to the American Dental Education Association, the average debt for dental students at the completion of their education is over $140,000 just for the educational component. That's not for living expenses and the debts they may have incurred for just surviving for 4 or 5 years. So we believe that this will be an added incentive to assist us in attracting dentists to our rural offices, and we look forward to working with the rural communities to implement the provisions of this legislation. Thank you.
Any questions?
Chair Greenlick, if I might, in talking with Sandy prior to the hearing, one of my other clients, the Oregon Academy of Family Physicians, Dr. Elizabeth Steiner, was unable to make it down this afternoon because of her clinic duties. So she asked me to distribute her written testimony and just to highlight the family physician's strong support for this program. They really understand the importance of getting family physicians into rural communities and how the challenges that they face. Many of them, the students that I've talked to at OHSU, many of them have upwards of $200,000 in loans as they're finishing medical school. And so it's the challenges that Dr. Allen was just talking about. They support the restructuring of the program that Scott Ekblad talked about. We think that that matching of physicians with communities and with specific openings will help move the money through the process more quickly, getting it to the, both to the communities and to the young physicians that need that funding. And the Academy of Family Physicians also supports adding dentists and pharmacists to the program. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks for your testimony.
Thank you.
I would, public hearing, close the public hearing on Senate Bill 188 and open up a work session on Senate Bill 188. I thought I'd wait till Representative Maurer comes back, but we can add him when he comes back. Is there a motion?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I would move Senate Bill 188 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Any discussion? Would you please call the roll?
Aye.
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 Excuse. Excuse.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Senate Bill 188 goes to the floor with a due pass recommendation. I think we'll ask Representative Maurer to carry it, so we need to make sure we give him a chance to vote when he comes back on that. We've actually done something. Are there people here on
337? Yeah.
Are you very far away or just the usual crowd? I think I'd like to open up 144 for a while, but if 337 is pretty fast. Oh, just Gwen and Claudia. All right, let's open up public hearing on Senate Bill 337A, and maybe you could tell us what we have here, huh? Yeah?
Okay. Mr. Chair, Senate Bill 337A modifies provisions and requirements relating to the notice of professional negligence claims to health professional regulatory boards and to subsequent actions of the board. It defines insurers relating to the persons making payments in response to claims for professional negligence and other technical points that these lovely ladies will bring to our attention.
I think it would be good for you to vote on it. All right, team, what have we got?
Thank you, Chair Greenlick. And members of the committee, I'm Gwen Dayton. I'm the Executive Vice President and General Counsel for the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems. And I think it's my task this afternoon to walk you all through this bill and explain what it does and what changes we've made. Before I do that, though, I want to thank Senator Bates for his leadership in putting this together. He really led a work group through some very difficult issues. The work group was comprised of the Hospital Association, the Oregon Medical Association, and the Board of Medical Examiners. And everybody has worked really hard on this bill and worked through, as I said, some challenging issues that bring us before you today with Senate Bill 337A engrossed. With that, let me tell you what this bill does and also what the Dash 4 amendments do, which we are suggesting. This bill combines two different concepts. First, the reporting that is required under the insurance code of healthcare practitioners by currently insurers to the appropriate licensing board. That's one issue. The second is the reporting that's required in the Medical Practice Act and ORS 677415 by healthcare facilities as well as physicians to the Board of Medical Examiners. I'll talk about the first issue shows up first in the bill. And I'll walk you through the terms of the bill, but as I do that, let me explain what the point was in proposing this. As I said, there's existing law that requires insurers to report malpractice claims against a healthcare practitioner, not just physicians, but more broadly than that. But there has been a lack of clarity in the law about who is included in this reporting requirement. For example, are hospitals that self-insure a physician against malpractice, are they required to report? We worked hard to resolve those ambiguities. So now, looking at line 24 on page 2, reporter means the primary insurer, a public body required to defend, save, harmless, etc. That's meant to make sure that it's clear that OHSU is included. An entity that self-insures or indemnifies for claims alleging professional negligence on the part of a covered practitioner, that picks up those hospitals that might self-insure or indemnify their practitioners. The goal was to make sure that the entity that receives a malpractice claim reports it. And we think we've done that with those provisions. Whereas before there were some gaps and people weren't sure, and that wasn't good for anyone. We also, backing up just a little on line 14 of page 2, defined further what a claim means. Before, it was pretty broad and ambiguous. Now, we've clarified it to mean a written demand for payment for professional negligence that's made in a complaint that's actually filed with the court of appropriate jurisdiction. So there's no misunderstanding when a claim has occurred. Those practitioners that must be reported include the practitioners who were in the old law, but we've also added nurse practitioners to the list. What is to be reported remains largely the same. We also clarified on page 3, line 4 through 20, what the board that receives this report can disclose publicly. That's where the dash 4 amendments come in. On page 4 of line 3, it talks about how a board that receives
Talk about those amendments.
Yes.
Line 4, page 3.
Yes.
Line 4 and 5.
Yes. Under the existing language in the proposed law, we say a board that receives a report of a claim pursuant to the section shall keep the report confidential and not publicly disclose any information about the claim if the disposition of the claim, what happens with it, doesn't result in any money judgment or settlement. So no payment to the, if there's no payment to the claimant, then the board that receives the report can't publicly disclose it. And actually what we intended with this was that the board doesn't publicly post on its website a claim that doesn't result in any kind of money judgment, but that if somebody asks about the claim, of course they can tell the person who asked about the claim that they received it. So the amendment in the dash 4s is designed to reflect that. They can't publicly post it on the website, but if somebody asks about claims against a practitioner, they are allowed to say, yes, we've received this claim against the practitioner. So that's, let me stop for a second. That's what the dash 4 amendments do. Are there questions about that or questions about anything I've said?
Representative Richardson has a question about that clause, not about the dash 4. You want to talk about that?
On page 3, subparagraph 5A, it says the board that receives a report of a claim, you just went over this under this section, shall keep the report confidential, may not publicly disclose or publish any information unless there's money paid. And so what this is essentially saying is if the injury to the person is not huge, meaning worth a lot of money, then it will never be disclosed because you can't get a malpractice attorney to take a case that isn't large because the cost is too great to prosecute that kind of claim. There'll be no motivation to settle a small claim because if they did settle and pay on a small claim, then now it's going to be disclosed, and so that means that it chills any attempt to be fair to somebody who has a problem that isn't a huge problem, but still, to them, it's a major deal. And so essentially what we're doing is putting in a statute a protection for the BME that they don't have to disclose information on small claims, that even if there's multiple claims with the same doctor. And so what we're doing is essentially going contrary to the whole idea of greater transparency, unless it's big enough that there's going to be money involved or in lawyers to make it work.
Mm-hmm. Chair Greenlick, Representative Richardson, I hear what you're saying, and I think we tried to address that actually in the Dash 4 amendment, that a claim that didn't result in any kind of payment wouldn't be publicly posted, but that certainly the Board of Medical Examiners, for example, but this would include a number of different boards, could, if somebody asked and said, have you received a claim against so-and-so, they certainly could say that they had. It just wouldn't be publicly posted. The other issue I hear in what you're saying is just a broader...
Right. Do you agree with that interpretation? That if somebody called, you would say, yeah, we have a claim.
She said, could.
Chair Greenlick, yes, and we could also provide it in hard copy, too.
So it's not posting it under the dashboard.
Correct. Okay. Is that could or would?
Chair Greenlick, Representative Richardson, it'd be our intention to make that available, because we currently do and have for quite some time.
Oh, may I follow up? You threw me at that one, because we had this conversation 2 years ago, and we've had some conversation since then, that it's not, you know, if there wasn't a malpractice settlement, then it wasn't necessarily disclosed. And, you know, so where are we at as far as...
Chair Greenlick, Representative Richardson, once a case is closed, whether there's a zero award today or some type of monetary settlement or award, that information is made available to the public.
Okay, so a person who wants to find out if a doctor has multiple claims can call up and say, I'm thinking about the situation, I'd like to know if there's been claims filed against this doctor, and the BME says, yes, there's been four claims, or and here's what they are, and here's how they got resolved, or is that... Is that the way it sounds?
Chair Greenlick, Representative Richardson, that is how it would be handled, or they could also be walked through the website so that they could access that information through the website.
But this says you can't publicly post it.
That's correct.
How could it be on the website?
Chair Greenlick, Representative Richardson, I'm talking about what's available today.
Yes, but under this...
We would be backing...
This says you could not post it on the website.
Chair Greenlick, Representative Richardson, that's correct.
Did you say you would tell somebody if they called you, even though you didn't post it?
Chair Greenlick, yes, we would. It said we would not publicly publish it.
Okay, so that's the first part. The second part is the chilling effect of this kind of language against compensating somebody who's been injured by negligence if the case wasn't large enough to justify a full-blown legal...
Chair Greenlick, Representative Richardson, what I hear from you is actually there's two parts to what you're saying. I think there is a general chilling effect on lawyers taking cases that don't result in any kind of substantial payout. And so I don't know that in your circumstance a claim would be filed to begin with, necessarily, if I'm understanding the issue that you're presenting.
Well, you've just kind of recommitted. You said that the threshold's getting even higher before you can get legal help. And so what I'm just trying to do is bring out if a patient has been harmed and it's not a large enough harm that a lawyer is going to take it, which has to be fairly substantial. I mean, it really does. The idea would be normally that, you know, we have insurance and things get resolved, but this wording would say, well, if we pay anything on this, now it's going to be open. But so actually, we're better off to protect the physician, not to pay anything.
Well, look at the claim. I mean, your claim is actually... A formal malpractice claim.
Gotcha.
The claim here literally means something filed in court.
Right.
So you're not talking about a complaint to the board, which is a different thing.
Right.
This is talking about a formal claim.
Speak to us, I will.
Well,
Chair Greenlick, Representative Richardson, the other point that I would add, and I was also going to defer to Claudia from the Erie Medical Association, who represents physicians more directly than I do as a representative of hospitals, but I think that as a general matter, physicians are strongly incentivized to settle cases rather than not, because a case that is not settled goes to trial. And that involves, as you know, very long and expensive procedure. And I think physicians, by and large, would rather settle and have the claim posted on the website than proceed to trial with a case due to the expense and the stress and all that's involved with that. So I hear what you're saying, but I think there are also equally strong incentives for physicians, as an example, but other practitioners as well, to settle cases rather than let it go to trial, because that's the alternative other than dismissal.
Okay. Keep going a bit.
Thank you. That subsection 5 on page 3 continues to relate to disclosure of information. And it talks about, on line 11, that if a board discloses information about a claim that's subject of a report, the board should indicate whether or not there was a finding or an admission of liability associated with the claim. And if there was no actual finding or admission of liability, then the board doesn't disclose the underlying facts. The board would not disclose the underlying facts behind the claim. And then the last subsection in line 17 is, and this is old law, it's just restated here, a board that receives a report provides copies of it to healthcare facilities that employ or grant privileges to the covered practitioner. So, for example, a hospital would get a copy of a report that had been filed. And then there's immunity for reporting as well. That is the reporting and malpractice claims. Any other questions on that before I talk about a different but related topic on reporting of docs? Okay. There is a parallel provision that requires...
I'm sorry, Representative Bonamici.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you. I had a question about how the 4 years was arrived at on line 9.
Oh, thank you for raising that. Yes, I kind of skipped over it.
4 years goes by really quickly. And it's my understanding under this language that you can reach the 4 years, and if there's not another complaint filed, no matter how egregious the first one was, it gets taken off. Is that...
Chair Greenlick, Representative Bonamici, thank you for raising that, because I didn't mean to skip over it, but I did. It was the consensus of the work group looking at this bill that if, in fact, there had been no other claims, for a period of 5 years, and that was a compromise number, that there would be essentially almost an expungement of somebody's record, the board in question would withdraw from publication any record. It doesn't mean that if somebody called the board that the board couldn't disclose that there had been this claim, but it wouldn't be published.
Well, I just think it's interesting that there's one set of rules for if you call and another set of rules for if you check the web. It's just a little confusing to me.
Chair Greenlick, Representative Bonamici, I think the idea behind that, we're trying to strike a balance, and as you can tell from this conversation, it's a difficult balance between the public's right to know. Let me back up for a second. I think there's two primary purposes for these reports. One is so that the board itself gets a red flag that there might be a problem with somebody they license. Do we want to investigate whatever happened with this claim ourselves and potentially take disciplinary action against the person? That's one goal. The other goal, of course, is information to patients about a practitioner that they may be seeing so they can be fully advised if this person is a good person or not a good person. When you're looking at that second goal, it's a challenge between...
Is there a third goal? Isn't there one about institutions checking on professionals?
Chair Greenlee, certainly there is, because the report does go back to hospitals, for example, and so we would receive notice that somebody might be able, yeah, and could take our own action or do our own investigation against somebody. Right. I appreciate that. But when you're looking at what the boards can do with information, you need to balance fairness to the practitioner for claims that might be filed but actually did not, at the end of the day, have merit. There are certain practitioners, again, I invite Claudia to speak up because I'm speaking more to a physician issue than a hospital issue, but that receive more claims than others simply due to the nature of their practice. OB is a common example of that one. So is it fair to make that physician, for example, look like a poor practitioner when it's really perhaps the nature of their practice that has led to this number of claims and none of those claims were ever substantiated? I mean, how you need to balance that against the public's right to know that this person might not be a good practitioner. That's the balance we tried to strike with this bill.
Mr. Chair.
loads of questions. I guess I'll just stick to the one about this phone call versus checking online. A lot of people, if it's not online, it's not there. So what kind of disclaimer are we going to put on our website to say, by the way, we don't put everything online. Give us a call. Is that what you're thinking?
Chair Greenlick, Vice Chair Kotex, I think we are going to have to put that kind of a disclaimer on the website and also direct the public as to where they can get some of this information if the bill passes in its current form.
Next question?
Oh, you go.
Yeah.
Hello.
Ms. Thiele, you talk about the work group, and I'm not a member of the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association, and I don't do malpractice cases at all. But who was on the work group kind of representing the general public?
Chair Greenlick, Representative Richardson, I would say that actually Kathleen Haley, sitting to my right, was the strongest representative of consumers, and I think she was a strong advocate for the need of patients to know.
I've never heard you can.
Your body was
that,
nodding so that you were that.
She was.
That's reassuring.
Mr. Chair,
yes.
Can I make a comment? Claudia Black with the Oregon Medical Association. Just in response to some of the questions, I think it is very difficult to achieve that balance between the patient's right to know and physician's right to be protected from unfair or misleading information that may be available to the public. As Ms. Eaton said, that the high-risk procedures, OB, some of the surgeries and so forth, those folks are more likely to get malpractice complaints filed against them, and in a case where there's a bad outcome, regardless of the skill and the performance of the particular physician, to have it posted on the website, these malpractice cases are very, very devastating to physicians personally and professionally, and to have it just out there, anybody clicks on the website and there it is, even if there's no finding of fault and no payment, is a very difficult thing for them to deal with. And even though they believe that it's important to have that information available if someone was to call in, having it posted there, even for 4 years may not seem that long to some folks, but for a physician who has his or her name up there for 4 years when they, in fact, maybe have done absolutely nothing inappropriate and have, in fact, had very good policy and procedure and just had a bad outcome is difficult for them.
Let me tell you, as I hope this committee stays together in the interim rather than getting a whole new shuffle of committees, this whole topic is something I think we really need to look at the various boards and how they balance, and the boards do it differently, their protection of the licensee and the protection of the public. And it seems to me this is a very important topic to have some overview and to deal with. And that's not to stop suggest we not do what's done here, because this is a specific thing, but I think we kept raising one issue after another in various of these bills, and it's got me not convinced that the right balance is always there. And it's something I think President Richardson raises some of these issues, I think there are.
Mr. Chair, I'm concerned because as we talk about what's on the internet versus what you find out from a telephone call, that's one thing, but the wording says a board may not publicly disclose or publish any allegations or factual assertions included in the claim unless the complaint resulted in a judicial finding or admission of liability. Well, that doesn't just say on the internet. I mean, what I'm hearing is that you can call and ask, and we can say, yes, there was something, but we can't give any facts or information relating to it. Is that correct?
Chair Greenlick, Representative Richardson, that is the point in which I think there was some lack of agreement among the parties, because it was my understanding that the... Representative Richardson, are you talking about page 3, line 13, the end of that line, through 15?
What follows from the dash fours, I think. What follows? After the
dash. Oh, okay. I was looking at, I thought you were talking about 5B.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yes. 5B, yes, line 13 through 15. In that case, the board would not be able to disclose at all, and that's about 95% of the cases.
No, they can't disclose.
It's my understanding, because most of them would be settled. And so there would be no judicial finding or admission of liability.
Thank you. That is important.
Chair, Chair Greenlick, Representative Richardson, if I could clarify just briefly on that point. 5B talks about if a board discloses information about a claim that's subject to the report, the board shall indicate whether or not the claim was resulted in a finding or admission of liability, and there is no disclosure of the underlying facts if there's no a finding or admission of liability. Not that the claim wouldn't be disclosed, but just that it wouldn't disclose the underlying allegations.
If it was settled out of court, it wouldn't say that the patient lost their eye due to negligence in surgery, and it was settled out of court for $7 zillion.
Correct, Chair Greenlink. If it was settled out of court, there would be a money payment, so that claim would be posted. But if there was no finding or admission of liability as part of that settlement, if somebody would see the claim on the website, they would know that it occurred, but there wouldn't be right underneath that.
Patient lost their eye.
It's not that the patient couldn't ultimately get that information if they chose to. As you may recall earlier, a claim means something that's been filed in a court of appropriate jurisdiction. So that's public record. They can get it from somebody else. It just wouldn't be posted right underneath the claim when there hadn't actually been any kind of finding of liability. I know that this is a little bit confusing to walk through, so I appreciate
the
questions.
I don't think it's confusing at all. Who do we have? Representative
Kotek? Oh, I just have discomfort when we say, well, they could find it somewhere else. I mean, we're having some transparency issues here, but I agree with you. I think we have to look at this in the interim. Some big issues.
Representative Cannon?
Yeah, question. Where did, maybe you said already, and I apologize if I missed it, but how did this bill originate? I understand that this is the product of a work group chaired by Senator Bates, but what was the initiative behind it in the first place?
Thank you, Chair Greenlick, Representative Cannon. This bill arose because there was concern, first, that the law regarding who should report the malpractice claims was ambiguous, and there was concern that some reporters, like self-insured hospitals, weren't reporting because we didn't think that we fall under the definition. Nobody liked that ambiguity, so that's what led to the look at the malpractice claims reporting, and we clarified that we are, in fact, reporters. That was the right thing to do, and so we went that route. Getting ahead of ourselves just a little bit, but on the second portion of this bill, there was concern, I think, on the part of the Board of Medical Examiners about reporting to them under that statute and whether there should be penalties associated with failure to report, and so that's why we took on that issue. This discussion of what is posted and disclosed came about as part of our overall look at the malpractice reporting law and how it was working. It just brought forth these other issues in addition to the who should report issue. There originally were two separate bills that were brought together in this one bill by Senator Bates and the work group that he put together. Did that help?
Yes, and I guess I have a follow-up question. It's a separate question, and that is, and I feel like there's this this real concern that the board has, and I think for some understandable reasons, about making information about claims public. I mean, but what's to distinguish this? I mean, a college or university that doesn't like it when the public knows the attrition rates of its students. And granted, we're talking about the professional livelihood of doctors, physicians, and others throughout the state. Nevertheless, are we not giving the public enough credit in its ability to look at claims, and if we're talking about OBGYNs, compare and looking at maybe at several, and say, wow, they all have claims or judgments against them. And I just wonder if we're not giving the public too little credit in its ability to sort of distinguish what is a reason to say about that doctor, that's maybe someone I shouldn't go see. There's been some real problems there. Versus saying, it's cropping up all over the place. So, do you have a response to that, Claudia?
Representative Greenlink, Representative Cannon.
Dr. Obstetrician, I'm missing
you. I'm thinking I ought to.
I was just actually going to comment on obstetricians, if I might. If you look at OHSU, for example, that takes high-risk cases for OB, and you looked at the obstetricians there, you might be more likely to see a higher number of malpractice cases because of the number of high-risk procedures that they do. You can see something like we have the example of lacerated kidney, where you look at that, and that sounds just horrible, but you don't know the circumstances surrounding it. And what my understanding is from what the BME has posted is just the information they receive in terms of the complaint.
Is that correct? So it's not anything that's been vetted. It's just that information. And it might be, you know, that the child died in childbirth or that kind of thing, but none of the circumstances that surround that. Is that correct?
Chair Greenlick, Representative Cannon, right now the board puts the allegation on the website, and that's the information that's reported to us by the insurer. So it would be a short synopsis of the allegation.
What?
Okay. You got some more to talk to us about?
I think I do. Thank you. I think the second...
Quickly,
I will certainly do that. The second part deals with the reporting obligation under the Medical Practice Act. It's existing law that healthcare facilities and physicians are required to report to the Board of Medical Examiners in certain circumstances. We're not changing in this law the circumstances in which a report has to be made. I'm glad to talk about those circumstances, but in the interest of time, we'll move forward to talk about the substantive changes that were made to that statute. We first looked at the statute, as I indicated, out of concern on the part of the Board of Medical Examiners that there was really no enforcement mechanism on their part against those who the board felt had not reported when they should have. And the board proposed a penalty against healthcare facilities as well as physicians, and that penalty is contained in the law now. There's now a penalty of up to $10,000 for failure to report by either a healthcare facility, which typically is a hospital, of course, but also ambulatory surgery centers fall under that definition. There's also a similar penalty against a physician who fails to report. And just briefly, what is reported by a healthcare facility is official action against somebody. So if we suspend someone's privileges, we do something definable regarding a physician who practices in our facility.
Restrict their privileges?
That would be an official action. That's an example. Terminate their privileges would be another example. Physicians have a broader scope of reporting. They report somebody who they believe is engaging in unprofessional.
Did what Kaiser did to Patel? Would that have represented where they restricted the kinds of surgeries he could do? Would that be reported?
Chair Greenlick, I'm not as familiar with exactly what Kaiser did with Dr. Patel, but if they did an investigation, they took an official action against him to suspend his privileges.
He didn't suspend privileges.
I'd have to inquire further about exactly what they did before I answer that question directly. If they limited his privileges, that would be reportable. Physicians report when there's concern about unprofessional conduct or incompetent practice. In addition to the penalty that now can be assessed against those who fail to report when they should, there is clarity in the law now about what healthcare facilities and physicians are to report to the VME. We really appreciate that part of this bill, I have to tell you, because there's been kind of a push-pull, everybody trying to do the right thing, so not a negative push-pull, but just between the Board of Medical Examiners wanting information that we often felt was peer-reviewed data and we didn't want to disclose because that would pierce that veil, and we're very protective of peer-reviewed data. But the Board of Medical Examiners, of course, needs appropriate information to do what they can, their investigation and the work they do with reports. So the language on page 4 of the bill lays out what can be reported, what must be reported to the board when there is a report under this section, and this was discussed extensively among all of us, and all of us believe that this gives the board what they need and also gives the reporters some comfort that we're not crossing that line into peer review data. Questions about that?
You done?
I think I'm done.
Team, I think this is something we want to chew on. It's clear this is an advance over where we are now. But I sense a little discomfort. Let's move this to next Tuesday. We're going to have time tomorrow, do you?
Tomorrow's the day, Mr. Chair.
Do we have time
tomorrow? We have a public hearing and then two other public hearings at the next session.
Yeah, let's move this to tomorrow. Give us a chance to look at it.
Tomorrow?
Tomorrow.
This one?
Tomorrow. We don't have to post them if
we can carry it over.
We can just carry over. Just to give you a chance overnight to look at it, I think, as we say, I think there's some discomfort in the overall area, but I think it's clear this moves us ahead without any doubt, making sure that things get reported. Representative Bonamici, can you wait just 1 second to hear what I'm going to say now? Yes, I know you have 1 second. So let me close this hearing. We'll have the public hearing. We'll have a work session tomorrow. We'll live tomorrow. We're not going to have time to deal with 144, but and we'll move it to Thursday. Is that right? But let me tell you, for those of you that are here interested in it, what I want to get an amendment to propose, and we'll have a chance to discuss. I haven't talked to anybody else on this, but I would like to think that we may want to include the stenographers as is in the bill, but delay the implementation of that piece for 2 years, until July of 2009, which would give the new board a chance to exhibit how they want to deal with this, to work with the stenographers. This will just be my amendment. I literally haven't talked to anybody else. But that's one thing I'll bring out. And if it doesn't work out right, it'll give us a chance to review it with the next legislative session if the problem is there. So you all think about that. I'm going to try and get that amendment ready to have for, so we can discuss that. If anybody else has any other amendments or things that they want to deal with on 144, we'll take it back up. First thing, because folks have been here waiting, first thing on the agenda on Thursday, this coming Thursday at 3 o'clock. And if anybody wants to talk to us, if there's somebody from out of town that can't come back on Thursday that would like to comment, we'll be glad to take that. Representative Bonamici, thank you. I just wanted you to hear where we were going. So let's close this. Have we already?
You closed.
Already closed it.
Closed 337. What are you opening up?
We'll briefly open a work session on 144 if there's somebody that needs to testify that isn't going to be able to come back. You can't leave any unidentified boxes here.
That's I was also going to move that we open the bill that Representative Maurer's carrying, but I don't know the name.
We have a motion to suspend the rules.
Well, you need to open the works. Close this work session.
You don't need. Oh, we need. No, you don't, actually. But it's all right. I'll close the work session on 144. We don't need to open a work session to suspend the rules. I've been instructed by higher authorities. We can just do that. And if there's no objection to suspending the rules. Representative Maurer, how do you vote on on Senate Bill 188?
I vote aye.
Aye. The aye is recorded, and
yes, I will carry the
vote. Thank you very much.
Sandy, do you need to have a work session or to take the vote on that bill?
No, you don't. That's what I was told by
he
Ramona.
Was instructed by
you
Ramona.
Don't have to open a work session. I was surprised to hear that too. But if it works out, we'll come back and open a work session on a different day.
Mr. Chair?
Yep.
Do you want to open 144 again?
Yeah. Let me open 144 if we have. You won't be able to come back on Thursday? Undue pressure. Tell us what's on your mind.
Well, Mr. Chair, while he's getting settled, I just wanted to say thank you for having this. I guess I was just, if we could find out, are there amendments coming from the discussion from the last meeting? I see heads nodding.
I haven't gotten any amendments.
Okay. Thank you.
I just gotten about 2,000 emails or something.
Yeah.
I just want to bring to your attention, you do have from, I do know that the parties had a conference call. I believe you all got an email that had a letter from Linda Russell with minutes from that conference call attached. Those are 27 pages for your review. And I believe what I've been able to ascertain from a quick read of those are there are really no areas of consensus. So,
yes. Please. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee that remain. I'm Dr. Frank Erickson. I'm MD, a radiologist member of the board of Radiologic Technology. Halfway through my appointment by the governor to...
Going to be called something else.
Well, that's our hope. I'm privileged to belong to this board. I think there are a lot of dedicated professionals that are working stiffs like me who take time out to do this above and beyond the call of duty. For some reason, this seems to be an unusual event in the history of the OBRT, the board. to address something that should have been done years and years ago, as you may know. What I'd like to do is read you just a small part of the background of this that brought me here today.
Oh, yes, please, a small part.
Sure. What you have in front of you is the work of 4.5 hours last night. Trying to get. That's why we're kind of anxious to talk to you today and thought we'd have more time to go into it in detail. I won't read this to you. But the first half, or the first part, is a 10-page letter. And the second part, and they're individually stapled, is our set of exhibits that go with that letter, just for your reference. Besides just the name change, this is really an attempt, and I understand that I'm a general radiologist. I through my last 20 years of being a general radiologist, I come into contact with all different modalities, and my career spans the growth of this industry to include many, many different modalities besides x-rays. For some reason, and that I can't address personally, the OBRT has not kept up with this explosion of technology that is now called medical imaging. In some hospitals, it's not called the radiology department any longer. It's the medical imaging department to reflect the fact that it's not just x-rays anymore. So that's the background of why the board was tasked by the last legislative session to try to catch us up. It turns out, after all of our endeavors, that we're probably the first state that's really going to address this in a meaningful way. So we're breaking some ground. We understand that. And we're not extremely skilled or experienced at rewriting the law, any one of us. But as a board, we've given it our best shot. And I'll try to explain why we're here today on this. The Ways and Means Committee asked this board why their technologies had no oversight. It was kind of a shock to find out that some imaging modalities just had none at all, and why this had been allowed to go on and what we were going to do about it. So a year and a half ago, the board started looking at this and trying to modernize the law. As you know, this bill has gotten through the Senate. The OMA at that time decided that it was okay as long as we left out the licensed practitioners, the physicians. So we assured them that we weren't trying to license the physicians about these things, and they allowed it to go through as SB 144A. The Oregon Hospital Association has a neutral position on it. With the exception of the ultrasound, National Ultrasound Society, SDMS, the other diagnostic imaging professionals that are other than x-ray techs that we're trying to include now, like MRI and nuclear medicine, are in general positive about it. And as an anecdote, we have not contacted the National Ultrasound Society about this. We're thinking local, we're thinking state organizations, and there just aren't any in the state of Oregon. But from my dealings with ultrasound techs all during my career, the subject would occasionally come up and say, gee, you know, you're not licensed. I said, yeah, we must have a good lobbyist. It's kind of a joke, you know, no one would dare bring it up to try to license the ultrasound technologies. But those we have talked to, members of the board have stated to me informally, we have informally discussed this, say that they generally, the ultrasound techs, say, yeah, we probably should be licensed. Now it turns out that now that it's come to the House, suddenly there's opposition materialized. We were asked last week to try to attempt to negotiate with the people in opposition. And we had this 90-minute teleconference, part of which is an exhibit for you to look at, a transcript of that. And it was supposed to be 60 minutes, turned into 90 minutes. And there was some very ardent discussion about these topics. And members of our board, me included, and I probably talked more than anybody should have, were trying to press the people that were opposed and saying, what do you want us to change? What would you like us? What would you like to see different? And they said one was, well, there's no representation. You'd have to change the representation on the board. And I said, fine. What do you think it should be? So we started actually getting to discuss and negotiate what we wanted to do. But it turned out there was an extra person that came to the conference who was described as someone related to a law firm in Chicago. And so it was as if they brought their lawyer. And he would interject when things seemed to be going well, that there's no discussion. And we got the distinct impression, and then the next day in writing, that unless we, the board, completely removed ultrasound references from this bill, and in fact never again even thought of adding ultrasound text to our legislation, that they would reach out from K Street, 1501 K Street Northwest in Washington, into the heart of the Oregon legislature and kill our bill.
Watch out for the black helicopters.
Right. Well, we were thinking black Chevy Suburbans, you know. But, so this is, you know, we didn't find out really who this was until I started doing Google search and found his website. So turns out he's not a lawyer. He's a master's degree from William & Mary in public policy.
Oh, but he's not relevant to this.
I'm sorry. It's just, you can tell that I'm kind of worked up about this, and we talked this over with the rest of our board members, and they got a little excited about it as well, independently of me. And it was the consensus of the board that we're not really going to stand for this. We've worked hard on this bill, and we think it's fair because it treats every individual imaging modality fairly. He doesn't single out any one of them any differently than any other, really. And it attempts to focus on what this board does. And it turns out this board does this very efficiently for the RTs and radiation therapists right now. It focuses on their professional competency and their conduct.
Can I ask you a question?
Yes, sir.
I understand the notion of going from radiological safety sort of things to diagnostic imaging. But you're sweeping along with you the therapeutic use of radiological technology, is that right?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
How does that fit into the notion that you're talking about diagnostic imaging rather than radiological safety?
It's a tradition that the radiation therapists are included in this because of, historically, it's been included because it was using ionizing radiation.
Well, but historically, sonographers aren't, so
true,
we're not
true.
Holding the history.
That's why we would have to expand the scope to include them as well. And the reason we feel so adamant about including them is that there are safety issues as well for ultrasound. It's just a matter of degree. Early in my training, we didn't give a thought to how long we spent ultrasounding someone 20 years ago. But now we do. And now it turns out that the more they study this, the more they find that it is a factor. Studies in mice, brain, fetal anatomy show failure of neuron migration in those exposed to certain levels of ultrasound. The longer, the worse. It's a dose relationship.
So the issue is not imaging. The issue remains safety. Is that what you're saying?
It's partially safety and partially conduct. Back in the end of this set of exhibits, you'll find Exhibit J. It refers to a specific case, and part of our motivation for this is a glaring lack of oversight that's resulting in one particular ultrasonographer that bothers those of us who know him and have worked with him in the past, who's allowed to continue practicing because there is no oversight, who probably shouldn't be touching patients. So that's part of our motivation, is because we have personal knowledge of the failure of the system. And I can go into gory details, but I probably don't think you want to hear that.
Any questions? Thank you very much for your testimony. We'll be back with this.
Thank you, Chairman.
When did
Thursday.
Thursday.
First
thing.
Mm-hmm.
Thursday, first
thing.
All right.
In chiropractor offices, often they give a modality using, trying to think of it as ultrasound and those kind of things. Does this extend to ultrasonic
therapy?
Ultrasound in physical therapy is a different tool that I don't believe we would be covering, but we would cover that in rules. We've been told by our Assistant Attorney General that we have a lot of latitude in how this is implemented, and that's what encouraged us to try to make it simple the first go around, and that we would cover with public input exceptions to licensing if we needed them. I mean, that's doable. There are other exceptions you might consider, and it really has nothing to do with industrial use of ultrasound or a lot of other categories where ultrasound is being used. It has nothing to do with patients or medical care. This is really targeted toward recognizing the fact that medical ultrasonographers are in intimate physical contact with patients, and they deserve oversight. So that's what I was trying to say. This is, on one side, the board focuses on professional competency, which is all the certifying statutes and regulations that are handled by national societies, and they do a good job. The other side of this, after I've been on the board for a year and a half, is that we spend a lot of time on people, on their conduct. It has nothing to do with their professional competency. It's how they behave on a job. And so we have a caseload that we manage. We spend a lot of time talking about criminal history, DUI, and all these things.
I will ask the board to be prepared to comment on Thursday on the extent to which a two-year delay would be a particularly bad thing. Okay. Let's close the work session.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
On Senate Bill 144A, it will be first item on the agenda Thursday at 3. Do you have any other business? Oh, we still have a committee left?
Yes.
Thank you all very much. We adjourned.